Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot. Tonight, as is our annual tradition, I present to you Inciting a Hallowed Riot. This is possibly my favorite show of the year, as I get to bring to you a collection of spooky stories, witchy songs, magical folk tales from across the pagan world. Each creator's information is in the show notes at incitingariot.com, and I encourage you to go check them out and support them. Curl up with your favorite beverage, gather your loved ones, and enjoy this introduction to this spookiest, most magical season.
Just think of your prospects, my darling, take heed. A sprinkle of glamour, a dollop of charm, trading family secrets and recipes long as your arm. Ask us to glance at your schedule next week. We'll churn you a forecast that wriggles and reeks, made of salt and umbrellas and typewriters too, and all of the things that you're ever to do. There's no need for vanity, no need for fuss. We know that you're bursting to be one of us. We stir up the truth, but it's never to harm. Steeped in family secrets and recipes, long as you're on. Tyranny's child has not broken us yet. Try as she might, not a drop will she get. Tyranny's tantrums have come into play, striking down witches for what we don't say. Oh no. La 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 la. On the outside we look proper and prim, but we battle nobility's ill-advised whim. Shameless and shining, we've always asked why. For what cooks in our cauldron can call down the sky? Best believe we fought hard when temptation arrived, threatening with lions and offering bribes. We'd not do her bidding and draw down the moon, though she murdered our brothers and mother for want of a spoon. Tyranny's child has not broken us yet. Try as she might, not a drop will she get. Tyranny's tantrums have come into play, striking down witches for want of a day. Oh no. La 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 la.
take care and learn how to dance when there's blood on the air. The world is a dangerous place, little one, but you already know there are marvelous deeds to be done.
Wicked and strong in our shining we stand, straight backed with a drop of the future to hand. It's when we are human that you must take care, but wonders will come to you, darling, if only you dare. Oh, if only you dare. Tyranny's child has not broken us yet. Try as she might, not a drop will she get. Tyranny's towers can't topple too soon, striking down witches for want of a spoon. Oh no. La 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 la.
not just your eyes. Take a step and only then will you know. Roll the bones, roll the bones, roll.
I hope this will do, said Mrs. Warren, turning inside the modest bedroom. Sarah set her suitcase on the bed with a heave. She smiled at her host and patted the case. Guess I must have packed a bit too much equipment for the trip. Nonsense, interjected Grace, as she stepped into the room carrying an additional camera bag Sarah had brought. If you're going to accomplish anything during your visit, you should be properly stocked up. Shuffling past her mother, Grace added the bag to the bed, winking at Sarah. Of course, dear. And what is that you're working on? Gracie mentioned something about architecture? Mrs. Warren trailed off. Sort of, Sarah shrugged. I'm working on a coffee table book of photography, mostly black and white stuff featuring classic New England architecture. Specifically, I'm looking to capture the spirit of the area before it's been overtaken by strip malls and fast food chains. Sarah stopped and pulled a portfolio out of her bag. Here are some similar pictures I took over in Westbury last month. Mrs. Warren thumbed past images of sun-bleached barns, rotted tool sheds, and Victorian houses set into hillsides. And you plan on taking pictures around town of our buildings like this? Mrs. Warren frowned. Yes, ma'am. Grace laid a hand on her mother's shoulder. Don't worry, I'm going to take Sarah out and show her all the best spots around here for pictures. Besides, wouldn't you like to have a book filled with pictures of home? Well, there's nothing much here in town that can't be found in spades anywhere on the East Coast. I guess it seems funny to me to single us out. What for? When I had the idea to create a collection like this, the first thing I thought of were all those late nights at school when Grace would talk about growing up here. She described all of the hills and houses so well that this place is always in my mind as an example of the charms of New England. It felt funny to do the book without including her town since it inspired me in the first place. Sarah and Grace shared a smile. Well, if you're looking for a traditional image, Grace ought to take you down to see the old church where Gran was buried. It's been abandoned now, but when my mother was alive, it was the heart of the entire town. She'd always talk about how they would meet up in the old church for worship, weddings, funerals, even town meetings. We may not use the church anymore, but it's still the home of our little local cemetery and worth a few pages in your book. With that, Mrs. Warren went out, leaving Sarah and Grace alone in the narrow bedroom. Ever since she had arrived in Maplehurst, Sarah had been surrounded by Mrs. Warren, her other daughter Julie, and grandson Nicholas. The entire family had been waiting as her car pulled up to the house, ready to welcome their guest. She'd barely had a moment of peace since being ushered into the mudroom, and she used it now to observe Grace. It had been 7 years since their days of boarding together in college, and Sarah could barely recognize the woman standing in front of her. Gone were the familiar punk rock shirts and nose ring, replaced with a cable knit sweater and muck boots. "You're staring," Grace said, catching her eye. Sarah shrugged. "Just thinking how much time's passed since school. I'm sorry I haven't come out to visit until now." "Hey, don't worry about it. It's not like I've come out to see you either. We've both been busy. Life moves and we move on with it. Simple as that." "You always did like to dwell on things." Grace took Sarah's arm and led her to the door. "Come on, let me show you the town before it gets dark. Then you can go back to any of the locations tomorrow with your camera." Arm in arm, the two women stepped out into the bright silence of winter in Vermont. Tall, thin Victorian houses swayed in the breeze between taller and thinner pine trees. Each tree sagged under the weight of unreleased snow clinging to its branches like a child to its mother. The ground was covered in a thick skin of white, furrowed gray at the road where the occasional car crunched past. Off they trekked over the sharp rise and fall of the Vermont landscape, taking in the sights. There was a smattering of old houses, lean barns, short rows of storefronts, and wide pastures where mud-matted cows stood in clumps, grazing a fresh, lain-out hay bale. The light was clear and pale, creating a feeling of warmth despite the chill winter breeze across their exposed faces. "Grace," Sarah said, unable to hold in her question, "why did you come back here? You used to talk about how small this town was, how you wanted to be somewhere bigger, see new things and new people. You were so sure you were meant for something different. Why didn't you stay away?" There was a long silence following the question, punctuated by the fall of boots in the snow. "Last year when Gran passed, I got the call from Mom. She seemed so lost without her here that I thought maybe if I could come back just for a month or two, I could get her on her feet. It's just once you're here, it's really hard to go anywhere else. This town, these people, it's like they have a way of getting their hooks into your life until you can't imagine how you ever did without the town for as long as you did. And when Gran... the whole town was just there, helping Mom and Julie and me. It was nice, that feeling of belonging to a larger family, having folks to lean on. I guess I came back in, and they just made it so comfortable I couldn't bring myself to leave again. Sarah didn't reply, letting Grace's words hang in the air between them. It wasn't an answer Grace would have given several years back, but Sarah couldn't pretend that she was the same girl from those days either. Each woman had changed in the way time changes all things, slowly and inevitably. After a thorough tour of the quaint downtown and neighborhoods, Grace began leading Sarah down a steep gravel path set between a wide avenue of aged pines and oaks. The trees were so old that their knotty branches seemed to reach overhead and join together in a canopy, creating a feeling of enclosure. The snow in the branches muffled the sound of passing cars until all that could be heard was the steady crunch of snow underfoot as they moved further into the shade. After several minutes of walking, the path opened into a wide clearing, revealing a white clapboard country church. Sarah shuddered, even standing in full sunlight. The church was a traditional box design with a large steeple rising from the top, where a shuttered window sat slightly ajar. There were heavy wooden planks nailed over the windows and an air of disuse that filled the area. Or almost disuse. Taking in the scene, Sarah noticed that the graveyard attached to the church looked very well kept. Mrs. Warren was right. The graveyard may have been as old as the church, but some of the mounding above the graves indicated that a few of the residents were quite recent. There was row upon row of modest stone markers stood in the snow like gray fingernails breaking the surface of the soil. "What a unique church," Sarah offered, stepping closer to the building. "Yeah," answered Grace. "We had Gran brought here last fall. It's a lovely spot, but a bit off the beaten track. The church isn't really used for anything, but the building is over 200 years old. When I was younger, one of Gran's friends told me that there was even another building here before this one. Another church, sort of, where they worship demons. I mean, probably just a local ghost story. Every town out east has rumors of witches and devil worship. Sometimes teens will come through at night, daring each other to get close to the doors before freaking out and running off, shouting how they heard things moving around in the dark, how there's something living in the church. They claim to hear demons." Sarah chuckled. "Yeah, superstition finds its way into most places out east, if I've noticed. The kids are more likely hearing squirrels or raccoons that have found their way in there. So what else do they say about the church? Ghost stories and supernatural occurrences always make for exciting additions to the book. Gives the town a little more color." "Well," Grace lowered her voice like she was telling a ghost story around the campfire, "the church was rumored to be a secret meeting place for a local coven of witches. It was a group of women from the town who had made a pact with a demon. Gran used to say in exchange for power in life, the witches promised the demon their afterlives. Whenever one of them would die, her soul went to the demon, and he'd raise her up to serve him as one of the night hags. The night hags are these horrible creatures that slink in through your window at night and lay on your chest, giving you bad dreams. Really freaked me out as a kid." As she took in Grace's story, Sarah couldn't help moving closer to the church until she was at the front door. Breathing deeply, the air tasted of aged wood, the smell of time slowly breaking down a thing, the smell of years passed through sun and snow wearing a stamp, a personality into an object. The doors were solid and heavy, built to withstand the fury of New England weather. Curious, Sarah gave the doors a tug, but they didn't budge. "What are you trying to do? You can't get inside. Besides, none of that's true about the church. It's just local legend," Grace said, hopping up the front steps to join her friend. "I just want a small peek," Sarah answered, tugging once again. "Come on, the building is empty, so what can it hurt? I'll bet no one has stepped foot in this place in years." Grace frowned, but took the other door and began pulling as well. Slowly, ever so slowly, the doors began to creak open to the light and the snow. Once the gap was large enough, the women stepped through into the darkness of the church vestibule. Although it hadn't been too cold outside, the air inside the church felt warm and stale. Heavy dust motes swirled about the newly disturbed room. There was no light inside the church but what fell through the door behind them. Sarah reached into her pocket and turned on her phone light. It was a small deterrent to the darkness ahead, but afforded the two enough sight at least to avoid banging their knees or falling into a rotted hole in the floor. Sarah reached back for Grace's hand, leading the pair of them forward to where the sanctuary should be. The hardwood floor was layered in dust, which contained traces of having been disturbed recently. Sarah thought of mice and rats creeping in through the floorboards and shuddered to picture their beady eyes following her in the dark. The light was weak, but it appeared the sanctuary was one long room with a vaulted ceiling. On either side, Sarah and Grace passed overturned rows of pews, hymnals with torn pages littering the floor like leaves. As they reached the front platform of the church, they both paused, taking in the strange sight. Instead of a pulpit or podium for preaching, there was a long, low table covered in deep scratches. Sarah dropped Grace's hand and ran her fingers along the grooves in the wood. She turned her light to examine the table more fully. "Grace, what were you saying about demons and hags?" Sarah asked, tracing her hands along the careful lettering etched into the front of the table. "I don't know, it's just all old wives' tales. This hasn't been an active church as long as I've been alive." Her eyes followed Sarah's fingers, reading aloud the table engraving. "What dreams may come, both dark and deep." "Well, not your average church, I'll give them that, but there's no way this place was used for devil worship. Maybe this is just a table for displaying a corpse, like they brought this out for funerals. I mean, but the church was closed up before they could finish the last one." Sarah shook her head. "Unlikely. Besides, that wouldn't explain how beaten up this table is. I'm not saying demon worship was happening here, but you gotta admit this is hardly an average decoration for a church. It was probably..." She stopped short, her heart jumping. What was that? She was certain she'd heard movement further off in the darkness. Sarah looked at Grace, holding her finger to her lips, then touched her ear and pointed in the direction of the sound. Both women strained, trying to listen beyond the soft movement of their breath. Then the noise Sarah thought she'd imagined came again, a bit louder now. Scratch. It cut through the silence, the sound of something sharp slowly scraping against wood. Sarah turned and met Grace's wide eyes. Scratch. With a nod, Grace grabbed Sarah's phone light and began to lead them back the way they came. As they picked their way around the fallen pews, the sound began to follow behind them. Scratch. The thud of their boots on the wood beneath them seemed to thunder in Sarah's ears as they drew closer and closer to the front door. Scratch. The sound seemed to reach for them, neither woman sparing a glance backward, their eyes fixed on the door ahead. Grace stumbled out into the sunlight first, and just as Sarah moved to follow her, she felt a sharp pain across her right shoulder. With a cry, she pulled forward and landed in the snow at Grace's feet. In the safety of the light, Grace examined her friend's shoulder, shaking her head. "Sorry, I got a little bugged out back there. Sometimes the dark just messes with your head. You must have gotten your jacket snagged on a nail by the entrance. This is torn right through your sleeve. It's lucky you only got a small scratch." Sarah smiled weakly, holding her torn jacket closed. That moment before she had pulled her sleeve free, it hadn't felt like a nail. It felt like a long, bony finger trying to catch and keep her. It felt like a hand trying to pull her back into the dark. Sarah shook her head at the fanciful idea. "That's probably enough exploring for today. We should head back before I find another way to give myself tetanus." Grace nodded in agreement, relief washing over her face, and they turned to leave. "Hold on a minute," Sarah said, a gravestone catching her eye as she went to turn away. Crunching closer, she hunched down to read the weathered inscription. "Patience Gardner, beloved wife and mother, 1808 to 1842, asleep." Sarah read the inscription to Grace, but Grace only shrugged. Asleep was probably their way of putting a pleasant spin on death, especially if the woman dying was so young. It's a common tradition in towns for, like, those weeping angel statues. Even Grandstone said asleep. "Maybe," agreed Sarah, but she kept thinking of the table in the church, of the scratching in the darkness, of a graveyard full of sleeping bodies trapped under the snow and the soil, waiting to wake. Without another word, she turned and began following Grace back up the path towards the house. As the women retreated, the church sat nestled in the snow as it always has, but behind the boarded windows, a clutching, craving thing began to crawl. That night over dinner, Sarah casually mentioned the church to Mrs. Warren, including the peculiar table on the altar, but avoiding the story of their rapid flight from the building. "Oh, nothing so strange as all that, dear," she brushed it off. "That church has been closed for nearly 50 years. I'm sure it was some teenage vandals who broke in and wrote that. Ought to be horsewhipped for desecrating the house of God, but you all these young folks seek out mischief in their own time. Now, never you mind about that place. It's just another old relic in a town of old relics. I bet the Petersons' barn is even older than that church. Sarah left the conversation at that, enjoying the soft discussions of the family about their daily activities before she excused herself for bed. Grace followed her from the table, leading them both back up the narrow staircase to Sarah's room. "Don't worry about today," Grace tried to reassure her. In the warmth of the house, surrounded by the sounds of family bustling below, it was easy to forget the panic of the darkened church. "We probably just startled a raccoon or something. Try and get a good night's sleep. Oh, don't worry about the creaks and groans in the night. It's common enough in an old house like this." With that, Grace wrapped Sarah in her long arms, then left the room for her own. Sarah leaned out the doorway to watch her friend walk away, swallowed up by the darkness of the hall. "Good night." As each of the family members went to bed, Sarah could hear them shuffling from room to room, the squeak of bed springs signaling time to sleep. She wondered what it must have been like for Grace, growing up in this creaky house, in a town with old buildings and older legends. One night in their college dorm, Grace had confessed that she used to struggle with sleep paralysis when she was growing up. When she was a girl, she'd lay in the dark of her room at night, unable to move as she felt a great weight pinning her to the bed. She'd cry, but end up silent, trapped, watching the shadows move around her room as she waited for daylight to come. Even as an adult, the memories had made Grace cry. The issue had cleared up as she got older and moved off to college, but the memory was still fresh. Sarah had hugged Grace close, picturing the effect of an old house on a young imaginative mind. After today, Sarah thought Gran's stories about night hags might have been more responsible, filling Grace's mind with thoughts of monsters creeping into her room at night. After hearing the story herself and seeing the church, Sarah began to understand why nighttime noises might spark such ideas. With the final creak of Mrs. Warren's box spring in the room above hers, all of the family was in bed and accounted for. Sarah lay still in the darkness and listened to the house breathing around her. The gentle creak of the boards, the trickle of water in the pipes. Concentrating on such quiet noises, it wasn't long until Sarah drifted off to sleep. In her dream, she was back in the church from this afternoon, but instead of darkness, the church was lit with a sickly blue light from sconces hung along the walls. Shadows flickered along the support beams, reaching up to join at the apex of the vaulted ceiling, like the ribs of some great beast. She lay flat on her back atop the carved table on the altar, and felt a heavy weight pushing into her chest, preventing her escape. She weakly tried to flail her arms, but the weight on her chest pushed harder against the wood. Her fingers found the surface beneath her, and she began to tear against it, fingernails splintering against the grain, fighting for breath. Around her, she could hear that soft scratch, scratch again. Could sense with her primitive brain the slow approach of predators. It began with her feet. Sarah could feel a thin, strong grasp on her ankle. Looking down, she watched in horror as a skeletal hand reached higher on her leg, pulling behind it a breathing, rattling corpse. The body was covered in gray skin stretched tight across its thin chest and fluttering loose around the arms. The hands, once human, were now curled at the ends like claws or the legs of a dead spider belly up. The thing wretched itself on top of her, its spindly legs dragging across the wood of the table with the long scratch. Bony knees and hips ground into Sarah's flesh as the thing scraped itself along her body, reaching for her head. Unable to resist, Sarah looked into what could only be called the creature's face. The head was narrow, with wide cheekbones flaring out, and a long nose that terminated in a dark hole. There were hollows set wide apart where eyes might once have been, giving the impression of a human skeleton topped with a horse skull. Sarah fought to get enough air in her chest to scream, but the creature seemed to weigh more than its form suggested, and she could barely draw enough breath to remain conscious. The weight above her increased as she felt her ribs straining to protect her organs from the pressure. There was the sensation of skeletal hands reaching up from below the table, holding down her arms and feet as Sarah's heart began to race like a rabbit against her chest. The creature reached down and took her face in its dry hands, scratchy like untreated leather, and the eye sockets above her began to glow a deep amber. All around the room came a rhythmic thump, thump, thump of dried hands pounding against the ground. The rustle of restless bodies easing forward filled Sarah's ears, but she couldn't look away from the light, glowing brighter within the deep hollows of the skull. Clawed fingers sunk into her skin, jagged nails scraping bone, and as Sarah opened her mouth for one final silent scream, the creature grasped her jaws, forcing them wider as it slipped that dry hand further and further down inside her gaping maw. Sarah's body struggled against the creature's in the darkness, but she didn't struggle for long. Grace woke to the sound of a muffled cry in the night. She slipped silently out of bed, worried that Sarah was sick in her room. Her feet fell instinctively through the hallway, years of experience leading her steps from every squeaky floorboard that could alert the family to her movement. She paused by Sarah's room, noticing that the door was slightly ajar. She listened in the dark for any sign of movement, her ears alert to hear anything at all. The unmistakable sound of a bed spring readjusting. Grace nudged forward in the dark and peered into the room. "Sarah," she called into the darkness. At the sound of her voice, the moon shone through a chink in the curtains and illuminated a scene so wrong, so horrifying that it instantly etched itself into Grace's soul. On the bed lay Sarah, her arms hanging limply off the sides of the bed, her face at an unnatural angle, mouth gaping wide in a silent scream. The body would have been enough, but there, atop her friend, sat the hunched form of a skeletal woman with a long, equine face, her eyes glowing in the dim light and her face twisted with the unmistakable look of hunger. Grace stumbled from the door as the creature turned to stare at her with those amber-pitted eyes. Slowly, the thing pulled itself down from the bed, its long fingers clawing towards the hallway as its lower body dragged behind it on the floor with a steady scratch. On it came, those grasping, talon-like hands, reaching one over the other, its lower body wriggling side to side with the effort of dragging forward. As the creature drew closer, its hand poised above her, Grace let out a shrill cry which echoed through the quiet house, then suddenly choked off into silence.
Well, I'd like to take this moment to recognize all the heroes that passed to the other side. And I call them one by one, underneath the moon and sun, to bless this night. And I shall call them all say, Ashe, Bob Marley, oh, be here today, Ashe, Bella Fitzgerald, oh, be here today, Ashe. Because we need your voices more than ever before,
Yes, we need your voices more than ever before. Yes, we need your voices more than ever before. Yes, we need your voices more than ever before. Lashay.
Strix. There was no question. His muse were less robust than his brothers and sisters from the moment he was born, and now they had gotten even fainter. None of the litter had opened their eyes yet, but Myra knew that one would not get the chance, even if she didn't intervene. She looked down at the pitifully undersized creature. A patched tabby strutted into the alley where Myra and her brood lay. Lila gave her a contemptuous look as she got closer.
"You haven't done away with it yet,"
Lila scoffed. Myra didn't look up. She continued to look at the small kitten, wishing things had been different, wishing he was as strong as the others. Small white paws, dark fur, white patch on the throat, dark nose. Myra tried to fix in her mind every detail about him she could.
"Oh, move out of the way. I'll do it if you don't. It's a shame to waste food. Even if he won't make much of a meal." Myra hissed at Lila. "I'll do it."
"I don't know if I can care for the others. Or myself, for that matter," Myra thought. She had a hard time finding much to eat as of late, even with Helia's help, and worried if she could make enough milk for all the kittens. She had hoped for a miracle. Some days she'd daydream about one of the two-leggeds taking her and her children into a warm home. But she'd found nothing more comforting from them than glass bottles being thrown her way. There was going to be no miracle. Nothing would help the small one now. She knew that this would give her the food she desperately needed and buy the rest of her children just a bit more time. But her heart still ached. It would be crueler to let him linger like this. Myra opened her mouth, and in a few seconds it was done.
"There now! It wasn't that hard! You first-time brood carriers, always so dramatic. You actually have tears right now. I've eaten at least 4 of my own kittens, and it never bothered me once. They were actually quite tasty. If it wasn't such a strain to bear the little beasts, I might have another litter, just for the chance to taste one again. Myra hissed and spat again. Lila raised her paw to strike. All right over there, Myra? A scarred pit bull loped over to the two cats. She bared her teeth at Lila. You wouldn't be thinking of hurting a new mother, would you, Lila? Lila turned tail and fled. Helia gave a snort in her direction. Never did like Lila all that much. She bothers you again. I won't feel bad about taking a nice big bite out of her backside. Oh, I almost forgot. I got something for you. Helia ran to the front of the alley and came back again, bearing a large mouse. She wagged her tail excitedly, dropping it at Myra's paws. This is nothing. There's a whole warehouse full of them. When you and your babies can move, I'll take you to it. The two-leggeds would probably love having some good mousers. Maybe they'll need a guard dog, too. I already had plenty. This one's for you. Myra ate, grateful for the extra food. She tried not to think this was the first time her belly felt full in a while. Thank you, Helia. I don't know why you're so kind to me. I already told you. You look like the cat from the place I was before. She was the only good thing about that place. The only reason I made it out. Helia noticed there was one less kitten curling up to Myra to nurse. She licked the cat tenderly, deciding not to bring it up unless Myra did. It's been a busy day. I don't know about you, but I could use a bit of rest. Helia placed herself in front of Myra and lay down. Myra picked her head up drowsily. There was something in the sound of the wind that woke her. She sniffed the air. Beside her, several kittens shifted restlessly in their sleep, squirming more closely against each other. A faint whine came from Helia, but she still slept. Blinking, she looked more closely at the shadows near a stack of slowly rotting cardboard boxes. Myra never had trouble distinguishing objects in the shadows before, but instead of the broken glass, mildewed rags, and other assorted city trash she was used to seeing, all she could make out was an inky haze pooling around the boxes. As she watched, all of the shadows seemed to take on the same velvety darkness. Myra shook her head as if that might clear her vision, but the shadows started to congeal into shapes with no relation to their surroundings. A legion of small, fragile figures could be made out, some of which occasionally shifted back to the formlessness of the larger shadow before coalescing into a tiny feline form again.
Mama?
Came a tiny mew, and dozens of equally high-pitched mews of
Mama?
Followed after. Myra hung her head. I'm sorry, little one. You should have been born to a mother on a comfortable farm somewhere, with kind big two-legs to bottle feed you, and kind small two-legs to adore you. I'm sorry I wasn't enough to save you.
We know,
answered dozens of tiny mews.
You cried, Mama. Only mamas cry. Not everybody cries for us.
The words repeated again, like ripples across a pond. Myra blinked. We? Us? There was only one kitten. She turned to look at the rest of her babies. They were all still there, still asleep, still alive, and moving fitfully. Who are you?
Ones who could not survive. Lost and found ones. We have each other. But we still need a mama.
Why?
Feed us, Mama. We're so hungry. Please feed us.
The small echoing mews filled the alley. I don't know how. I wish I did. You'd still be alive if I knew how.
Feed us, Mama. Feed us,
came the insistent mews.
We're so hungry.
I don't know how. Whoa. Myra, hun, you all right? Myra felt a large wet tongue on her side. She opened her eyes and saw Helia's worried face. One of her kittens started to mew and she flinched. It was the perfectly normal and healthy mew of a hungry kitten. She trembled and gave it a tentative lick. The kitten was warm and solid. Myra moved to start to nurse her and the others started to move closer. She looked at Helia. Just a nightmare. I guess I knew the little ones needed to eat now. When Myra was finished nursing her children, Helia got up to leave. I'll be right back. I'm just going to the warehouse to get us some food. It's going to be all right, Myra. Just a couple of days, we'll all go together. Not too long after Helia left, Lila came into the alley, followed by two cats Myra didn't know. I know Helia's gone. She won't be back for a while. The fur bristled on Myra's back. What do you want, Lila? Breakfast. The three cats started towards Myra. She hissed at them. All I need to do is hold out till Helia comes back. I can do that. But even if she had been well-fed and not weak from giving birth 3 days ago, Myra was small and young. The two cats with Lila were strong and well used to scuffling with bigger opponents. After the first few blows, Myra was dizzy. The world started to blur in front of her. As she fell, she could hear the kittens crying behind her. I can't feed you, she thought. And as soon as I'm gone, they will eat you.
We're hungry, Mama,
came dozens of little mews. Little ones, I wish you could eat them. Immediately, the shadows from the alley gathered, and a sea of small, indistinct shadows crashed over Lila and her friends. Myra heard their pained yowls, but couldn't see anything besides the forms in the shadows pouncing over and over again, little white teeth growing more distinct in the shadows, every now and again covered in bright red. Eventually, the yowls stopped, and even the massive shadows stopped moving. One small figure came away from the larger body of shadows and dropped a bit of meat in front of Myra.
For you, Mama.
Thank you, sweetheart, Myra answered.
When it's time for a change, you know, your shiny seed must grow. But it can be hard to let things go. That's when the rain must flow. Rain down, rain come down. Wash my worry when the rain come down. Rain down, rain come down. Wash my worry, oh. My worry, oh.
worse it down, down. When the rain come down. Rain down, rain come down. Wash my worry when the rain come down. Rain down, rain come down. Come rain down on me.
Well, I was born at the foot of a mountain, but now the mountain calls me home. I can hear its voice upon the wind as all this world I roam. No matter where I journey on, there's just one place I'll call my own, and one day I'll get back to it, I know. I tuck my teeth on the desert floor, steps on the back of a horse. Once the storms roll down the canyon walls at night, where eagles fly and lions roar, the mark of the hunter on my door. I give thanks for their sacrifice as I leave mine behind. 'Cause I was born at the foot of a mountain, but now the mountain calls me home. I can hear its voice on the wind as all this world I roam. No matter where I journey on, there's just one place I'll call my own, and one day I'll get back to it, I know. Daddy taught us to carry light wherever we may go. So tell one knows just where I am, but to his light I'll always hold. But what is more precious than this old world may hold, but all I've learned, I still get cold. For up that sea of sand, I'll never get my bill. The fires burn and the people's dance, I know one day I'll have my chance. For the mark of the whole come, I carry still. 'Cause I was born at the foot of a mountain, but now the mountain calls me home. So this world I roam, no matter where I journey on, there's just one place I'll call my own, and one day I'll get back to it, I know. 'Cause I was born at the foot of a mountain.
Love, could you put a little faith in life?
you coming, wrap it round me like if I lover, let me stay a while, put your trust in lullabies. I don't know who's wilder, I don't really have to try to know all of the answers. I will know you by and by. Lover, could you trust me and believe in lullabies? Whoa, 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 lover, let me stay a while and I'll weave you.
Purveyor of Small Enchantments by Brina Garin. Read by Brina Garin. Music by Kevin MacLeod.
Don't you have anything bigger? The tall, brawny fellow with the elaborate crest sewn onto his jacket had been browsing through my selection of bespelled knives for 10 minutes, examining the display from one end to the other as if he expected the contents to change. I sighed.
I don't deal in enchanted swords, young man.
My voice was rough, cracking in the appropriate places for the old crone I was pretending to be. Everyone expected witches to be ancient hags with warts and wrinkles and gnarled hands. Only certain witches could get away with the motherly angle. The ones I knew who did dealt almost exclusively in matters of the heart and the management of household affairs. Their wisdom dispensed over steaming cups of tea and plates of homemade cherry cake. A witch who dealt in philtres and charms and the occasional hexing brew simply couldn't wear comfortable dresses and walk around whistling to herself while the cauldron bubbled. If my customers walked in and saw a nondescript middle-aged woman with a gingham apron and a friendly smile, they'd never trust my advice. Nope, it was widow's weeds and hooded cloaks and theatrical cackling for me. I had an image to maintain. The big fluffy cat, who could often be seen sunning his belly beside the display of suncatcher gems, was pushing it. And I was only able to get away with him because my sweet baby Balthazar was a proper-looking archetype of a witch's cat, his fur the color of spilled ink from nose to fluffy tail, save for the tiny white star on his breast. The young man frowned at me.
"Well then, where am I supposed to get one?" he asked, almost petulantly. I fought the urge to roll my eyes and douse him with the remnants of my tea. First sons were all the same. Arrogant, underprepared, and always shocked that the world didn't deliver the object of their quest on a silver platter. Enchanted swords weren't to be bought or bartered for, they had to be won. Usually by some trial of wit or skill, or by wresting it from the grasp of some monstrous creature after you'd dispatched it with another, more ordinary weapon. And even then, most of them were functionally useless, except to wave around to inspire an army, or to hang on a wall as a reminder of past glory. Every thrice-blessed blade of purest gold I'd ever seen had been lying in pieces on a litter, beside the mangled remains of the idiot who'd tried to wield it against some creature or other,
attacking head-on instead of relying on subterfuge, and winding up smashed to a pulp for their hubris. The only enchanted swords you could actually fight with weren't blessed at all. They were cursed, and there was always a price for using them. Better to stick to more earthly blades. Good steel from a good smith, imbued with family honor and a mother's love, rather than trading in empty grandeur. First sons never understood this. Second sons rarely did either. Third, fourth, and fifth sons usually grasped the concept, especially if they happened to be the youngest of the bunch. That was as far as I'd gotten in the way of adventuring youth. I'd never seen a sixth son in my shop, much less a vaunted seventh son. With scathing potions and infant mortality being what they were, I was pretty sure I never would, either.
"Pull it from an anvil or a dragon's hoard like everyone else. A blade of my making will serve you better than some gilded bric-a-brac, small though it be," I told the first son.
He frowned and turned away to examine a staghorn rack hung with amulets. Balthazar rose from his nap, stretched to his full length, and stalked over to the coat rack for his evening shift of baleful glaring and well-timed yowls. The bell above the door rang as another customer shuffled in from the weather. A girl this time, still young enough for ribbons and rag dolls, but sporting the telltale signs of neglect and despair. Her dress, once fine and serviceable, hung in tatters, and her small hands were red and chapped, likely from scouring pots and scrubbing floors. Her thin shawl was faded and patched on one side. There was a hungry look about her that I recognized immediately. This was a first daughter. Unlike first sons, they tended to be clever and canny and hard-working, often outwitting through kindness and determination that which much lazier adults might never defeat. They always faced danger head-on, and they almost always made it home again, if they didn't carve out a place in some distant kingdom or wind up marrying a prince after rescuing him from some terrible curse or enchanted prison. In some cases, I'd also heard them called true daughters, especially if a cruel stepmother or displacement of some sort was involved. They typically had little to no money, usually only a few pennies or an heirloom sixpence, which I would take, or some trinket like a lock of their dead mother's hair, which I would always refuse. Coin was coin, but trinkets were always talismans, and I wasn't cruel enough to let some poor waif face an oncoming challenge without that needful protection. This one looked like she'd just been kicked out the door that very night, which meant I could expect a second daughter or a stepsister within the month. They were always well-supplied, spoilt to rottenness, and without fail, the most appalling little creatures you can imagine. From his perch on the coat rack, Balthazar narrowed his blazing eyes at the girl. His tail twitched. The first daughter put out a hand very slowly, talking to him in smooth, sweet tones. Balthazar deigned to inspect her fingers with his velvety black nose, then stretched into a perfect arch and jumped down, sauntering into the alcove at the back with his bottle brush tail held high. With a curious tilt of her head, the girl followed. Oh yes, this one was on the right track. The first son came back with one of the lesser protection amulets, an ashwood wand that I was certain he didn't know how to use, and my second-to-last pair of seven-league boots. I made a show of hemming and hawing my way through the negotiations of payment, letting him think he'd gotten the best of me. I knew the game well enough to empty the pockets of the most miserly of patrons, let alone some rich man's son with his father's gold burning a hole in his purse. First sons were always loaded. Their fathers sent them forth with every possible provision, thereby dooming them to failure when their supplies ran out and their own meager wits failed them. He would have done better to take a knife than the wand. I was sorry to lose the boots, too. They hadn't come cheap. But at least his second or third brother could loot them from his corpse and have an easier time of things when it came their turn to go questing. The first daughter left not long after the first son did, he shouldering his journey pack and putting on the boots, she darting from the alcove and out the door like an escaping bird, something small clutched in her hand. I smiled. "Balthazar," I chided, reverting to my normal voice and the honeyed tones I lavished on my beloved pet. "If you keep trading my hagstones for butter and bits of dried fish, I'm going to have to send you down to the riverbank to find more." Balthazar, back on his evening perch, licked his chops and began to wash his face, as if he hadn't heard me. It didn't much matter. The tumbled pebbles with holes worn through by grit and time were easy enough to find when the river was low. Occasionally, I'd even made them myself with a hand drill and copious amounts of coarse sand. Lesser hagstones didn't carry the same scrying magic as their naturally made counterparts, but they could still be made into embellishments for dowsing rods or lucky charms that would jump and tremble whenever danger was at hand. And after all, despite being a witch, I wasn't completely without principles. I could let one minor charm go for a little girl on her first quest. Poor thing. Maybe it would help her find her way home again. It was getting late. Technically, there were no set business hours, but I liked to close up when sunset approached. The evenings were for working in the garden, then supper, then a mug of something fortifying while I made new charms for the stall, or read a book while Balthazar purred on my lap. In my experience, only the desperate or dangerous, or the desperately dangerous, or the dangerously desperate, came by at night anyway. As I was drawing the curtains and lowering the heavily carved oaken barricade into place across the front door, I thought I saw movement out of the corner of my eye. A flick of my finger lowered the lamp so that I could see properly out of the window. I scanned the darkening courtyard for a late customer or perhaps a loitering crow. Nothing moved. My eyes picked out the familiar shapes of the garden wall, the grindstone, and the low stone circle of the well. It all seemed normal enough, and I would have dismissed it all, except for the way Balthazar had gone still on his perch, eyes and ears trained on the window, whiskers at full attention. A loud clatter made me start out of my skin. The broom I kept by the door had fallen, the sturdy hawthorn bouncing off the wooden planks of the floor with a sound loud as thunder to my straining ears. Balthazar leapt from the coat rack and hid behind my ankles. I could see his already fluffy tail lashing beneath the hem of my skirt. It was three times its normal size. A wry smile turned up the corner of my mouth. "I know, fella. Scared me, too." I bent and scooped the cat into my arms. His furry weight was reassuring and warm. Balthazar nuzzled his way under my chin. "Don't worry, boy. I won't tell anyone. Your fearsome witch cat reputation will remain intact." Hefting the cat with one arm, I made doubly sure the door was bolted tight, then moved into the back of the shop where a comfortable chair and a good supper awaited us both. And for a while, all was quiet. I munched my way through grilled trout and sweet potato pasties, while Balthazar contented himself with a dish of offal and pan drippings on the floor at my feet. There were books to be kept, supplies to be tabulated. The notes in arithmetic were so familiar I could have done them blindfolded, never mind while the other hand occasionally lifted to bring me another bite of pasty. When I finished, I scrubbed my dishes in the wash basin and dried them for the shelf. Some of my contemporaries had ridiculed me for this mundane practice. "Imagine," they said, "a witch of her standing, well out of her apprenticeship, and still she has so few servitors. And she doesn't even make them do the washing up." Honestly, I would have liked to see any of them try to teach a cat to wash dishes. Balthazar and his white claws, sharp as meat hooks, would swiftly have put an end to any such tomfoolery. My other helpers were even less suited to household chores, and I wasn't about to go and make them into something they weren't. Another witch might have tried. I knew better. After all, I had principles. And, if I might flatter myself, a functioning brain. the sun disappeared behind the trees in the west. A pot of whorehound and licorice root tea simmered on the stove. Cackling is so hard on the throat. Perched in my favorite chair, I sipped the hot brew and examined my notes on a new restorative potion recipe. It still needed testing before I would put it up for sale, but the initial results were promising. There was a stack of parchment scraps on my workbench that was almost big enough to be compiled into a new grimoire. Whether it would be for the kitchen or the cauldron, I hadn't yet decided. Perhaps it would be both. It was full dark when I heard the commotion outside. I paused, my fingers stilled. A leaf of potion ingredients in mid-turn. Once was chance. Twice would be... Yes, there it was again. Trouble. I got to my feet and hurried to the front door, Balthazar bounding at my heels. He sprang onto his perch and glared out the window. His tail lashed. I heard him growl. I peered outside. The yard was still, just barely washed with the first silvery light of the moon. A few leaves scuttled across the cobblestone walk, like startled pheasants. A few dozen yards up the path, I could see a lantern swinging in frantic, bobbing arcs. Someone was running, almost too fast to see where they were actually going, and heading straight for my little cottage. I had a sinking feeling that I knew who it was. "Help! Help! Open the door!" As expected, gods above and below, sometimes I hate being right. The first son barreled into my yard, promptly tripping over the low garden wall. The lantern tumbled through the air, smashed against the side of the nearby well, and fell in a spluttering wreck to the ground. By some miracle, its bearer did not share its fate, but staggered on to hammer the door with his fists.
"I don't give refunds on improperly used magical items," I called through the planks.
Somewhere in the forest, something roared.
"Please!"
His voice carried the shrill edge of dangerous desperation.
"Let me in, and my father will reward you handsomely. Riches, treasure, half the kingdom, anything! It'll be yours for the asking!"
Wait. This wasn't a first son. This was a king's son. I scrunched up my face and resisted the urge to groan. King's sons were even more obnoxious than first sons. More brazen, more entitled, and even less prone to heeding good advice. They were either entirely successful on the first go, or made an utter wreck of the countryside and got half the inhabitants killed with their stupidity. Walking disasters waiting to happen. And if I had to hazard a guess, I'd say that this one had probably tried to steal something from the giant's keep a few leagues distant, and, like a royal idiot, had gotten caught red-handed. And now here he was, back at my door. Well, the broom had tried to warn me. I sighed in disgust and lifted the latch. "All right, come in then, if you're going to batter the door down." The king's son all but fell over the threshold and scrambled to hide behind my skirts like a terrified child. Balthazar hissed at him. He flinched. I shot the furious feline an amused grin, then calmly regarded our guest.
"Well, out with it. What did you do?"
"Nothing." He was a terrible liar. It stank on him like weak old lutefisk.
"Not a blessed thing. Will you close the door already?"
"Not until you tell me what's coming.
If you wait much longer, it'll be here."
"You'd best explain yourself quickly then, hadn't you?" Another roar shook the cottage, and out came the story. He'd used the 7-league boots to carry himself to the nearby keep, as I'd surmised, and the lesser protection amulet had been enough to help him sneak past the less-than-vigilant occupants. And then, in some nebulous way that he deliberately obfuscated, it had all gone straight to hell. He'd wound up running for his life with a murderous giant in hot pursuit, and now here we were. Satisfied, I closed the door. "All right, get up, come on." I nudged him with my boot. There wasn't time to pretend to be a decrepit old hag, so I proceeded back toward the kitchen at my usual brisk pace, rather than risk the delay of a theatrical limp. Balthazar yowled behind me, and I heard the prince scramble to his feet.
All right, I'm going. Mangy beast.
You touch that cat, I leave you trussed up in the courtyard with an apple in your mouth. I opened the potion cupboard and removed a few jars. No time to brew anything much. This was going to be rough. I would have to trust the protections I'd built around my home, and whatever additional magic I could conjure at a moment's notice.
Wait, you're not old. How can you be a proper witch if you're not old?
My unwanted guest poked at one of the wreaths of dried herbs. I resisted the urge to tell Balthazar to take a swipe at his ankles. We didn't have time for a discussion of ridiculous stereotypes. Didn't your mother teach you anything? My age is the last thing you should be worrying about. And you'd better hope I'm a proper witch if you want to survive the night with your skin intact.
What are you going to do?
First and foremost, I'm going to protect my home. And if that goes well, maybe I'll think about keeping you safe, too. I turned to find him reaching a curious hand into my working cauldron. I wouldn't do that. It bites. It didn't, but it was worth watching the prince's face turn chalky. Hastily dumping the contents of the jars into a bowl on my workbench, I stepped out the kitchen door to draw water from the well. The king's son craned his neck to follow my movements.
Wasn't there a well in the courtyard?
I pulled the dripping bucket over the lip and unhooked it from the rope.
Yes. Why do you have two wells?
Not important. What's important is that you've brought an angry giant to my house, and now I have to deal with it. I carried the water inside, picked up the bowl, and made my way toward the front. Stay here, and don't touch anything. Outside, the crashing and roaring had grown even louder. The tall oaks around my cottage were swaying like river reeds, and I could smell something rank and gamey on the wind. Giants. You could always smell them before you saw them. And this one probably wouldn't be in a mood to talk. I dipped my fingers into the bowl and flicked them at the stone wall, the fence posts, and the rose bushes surrounding the gate. The rest I poured into the bucket. Then I waited. Soon enough, the giant stomped into view. He stood nearly as tall as the peaked roof of the cottage, his bulky form covered in a rough leather tunic the size of a festival tent, and boots I could have paddled across a country's worth of lakes. And angry? Angry wasn't the word. He was raging. I muttered under my breath, and the rose bushes at the gate quivered. Their thorny tendrils spread over the ground in a thick, spiky carpet. It was hardly a deadly obstacle, but it was enough to stop the giant at my gate. He snorted and paced, fists clenching and unclenching in frustration.
Listen, I called out to him. I understand your anger, but your quarrel isn't with me. It's with the king's son, and he's not here.
Quietly, I hoped the idiot would obey my orders and stay out of sight. The giant roared, spittle flying from his lips, and took a stomping step toward the cottage, then recoiled as the rose bushes reached up to lash at his ankles.
You don't want to do that, I warned. I'd rather not have to fight you, but I'm not going to let you trample my house to pieces.
I didn't know what the king's son had done, and for the moment, I didn't much care. This was my home, and I was going to defend it. My fingers flexed. The fence posts creaked. The stones of the garden wall trembled in their mortar. The giant took a single moment to look annoyed, then charged. I threw up my hands and shouted in the old tongue. Stones whizzed through the air and pelted the giant. The fence posts flew from their moorings like blunt spears, bouncing off the leather tunic hard enough to dent an elephant's ribs. The giant grunted, batting the missiles out of the air with slow, heavy-handed swipes. None of it was doing any real damage, but I hoped it would be enough of a deterrent to send him packing.
I mean it, I called. Go on your way or go home, but you're not coming in. The brute growled and took another step along the wall, looking for a weak point. There was a particular spot that was a foot or two shorter than the rest. A repair I'd been meaning to get to. The giant made for it.
Hey! Don't you do it! I'm warning you!
Despite my shriek of protest, the giant threw one tree trunk leg over the gap, his booted foot coming down squarely on my vegetable garden. A summer's worth of produce was smashed to pulp in an instant. I felt my hackles rise in fury. That's it. I seized the bucket at my feet, ran to the gate, and flung the contents as hard as I could. For a moment, nothing happened. The water, tinged green from the potion I'd dumped into it, dripped quietly down the trunk of a nearby tree. Then, the branches began to stir. With a low, sonorous groan, the roots trembled and lifted from the dirt, and the tree took a step. Sensing the new threat, the giant lifted his foot from my poor garden, now little more than a crater in the dirt, and turned just in time to catch a bough of elder square in the face. The battle raged outside my wall for several minutes. The giant was formidable in his own right, but he was no match for the elder tree. Punches and swats that would have felled an ox did nothing worse than shift the bark. Attempting to grapple is pointless when your opponent is rooted to the ground. After several failed attempts, the giant missed on a swing and stumbled. The tree's aim, however, was true, and the blow lifted the giant off his feet and sent him sprawling into the underbrush. I was pretty sure I saw a tooth go flying. I'd have to retrieve that later. Giant's teeth were worth their weight in gold. "I told you!" I bellowed from the gate. "If you know what's good for you, you'll go on home before I wake another tree." I didn't have another bucket of potion handy, but he didn't need to know that. Grumbling and swearing, the giant picked himself up and began limping in the direction of his keep. I waited until he was out of sight before I breathed again. That had been entirely too close. The elder tree settled back into its accustomed place with a shudder and a staccato rustle of leaves. I patted the trunk fondly. "Thank you, old friend. I'll bring you rainwater from the barrel in the morning." The tree groaned its approval, then settled back to sleep. I smiled. My city colleagues could keep their nonsense about servitors and household duties. I wasn't about to make a tree do the sweeping. "Is it gone?" The king's son poked his head out the front door, still visibly pale from the ordeal. Oh, right, he was still there. I'd nearly forgotten. "Did you kill it? And have to worry about reprisals from other giants and the bother of removing a massive rotting corpse from my front yard? Absolutely not!" I left the elder and returned to the courtyard. "He's gone home. You should do the same." Balthazar trotted to my side, picking his way through the mess of stones and splintered fence posts. "Oh, thank goodness for that!" The prince slumped in relief. "When I return, I'll make sure my father rewards you handsomely for saving my life. Anything you wish, you have my word." "I'm going to hold you to that." "Oh, I would make a list." "What on earth did you do to make the giant that angry?" "Make off with his favorite harp? Trick his wife into giving you all their gold? Beat him at a porridge-eating contest?" Braver now that the immediate threat was gone, the prince scoffed and waved a hand imperiously. "It was all a huge misunderstanding. Honestly, when you put a king's son into bed with your 7 daughters, especially one as gallant as I am, you must expect that something will happen. It's just understood." A muscle in my cheek twitched. Without a word or a sideways glance, I shoved him toward the low stone circle that marked the mouth of the well. There was a brief cry as he tripped, then a very satisfying splash from below. A few epithets were tossed my way before he realized that he wasn't alone in the watery depths. A good deal of screaming followed, sending a flock of blackbirds flapping noisily away from the surrounding trees. Balthazar rubbed against my leg and purred. "There are some things," I said, reaching down to pet him, that I simply will not abide, king's son or no. I hope you've enjoyed my story, A Purveyor of Small Enchantments. For more information on my written works, please visit breenagarin.wordpress.com and subscribe to my monthly witchcraft show, Hex Positive, wherever you get your podcasts. Have a wonderful Samhain season, and remember, always practice safe hex.
One flies in to case the joint, boldly struts around. Two fly in to make it three, laugh a while and knock each other down. Four flies in with a frowning walk, gains a laugh from out a squawk. But it's five who owns the place and proves it with a look, stopping six and seven in their tracks from smuggling a book. Words within our grasp, do we let go? Do we fly heavily with the weight of what we know? Words within our grasp, do we let go? Do we fly heavily with what we know? My friend bids me come and see the ravens in the library, setting quiet pages free. My friend bids me come and see the ravens in the library, setting quiet pages free. One for fiction, two for truth, three for bikes and bathing suits, four for sci-fi fantasy. Five loves art and ancient skulls, six eats periodicals, seven leaves in poetry. One hangs out on the drama shelves, but keeps the monologues to herself. Two and three are studying jewels. Four reads all about the Huns. Five won't share the shiny ones. Six and seven may belong to us. Words within our grasp, do we let go? Do we fly heavily with the weight of what we know? Words within our grasp, do we let go? Do we fly heavily with what we know? Hours of study flying by, words soaked up by beady eyes, long debates into the night, pages flying everywhere. Seek the language word by word, like the black and clever bird. Never let it bring you down, all the things we haven't figured out. My friend bids me come and see the ravens in the library, setting quiet pages free. My friend bids me come and see the ravens in the library, setting quiet pages free. Seven reads about the gods, chuckles to herself, to the rest she never lets on. Try to catch a glimpse of them, bickering like mortal men, feathers on the sidewalk. If you heard a raven say such horrible words as the ones you may have heard in your day-to-day, would it make you choose your own more carefully around the ones you love? My friend bids me come and see ravens in the library, setting quiet pages free. My friend bids me come and see the ravens in the library, setting quiet pages free. Setting quiet pages free. Setting quiet pages free. Setting quiet pages free. Seven little rings sitting on the shelves. Focus on the light and keep it to themselves.
but we feel you're slipping away. And if you have to go, you go on into that light, peaceful places you'll go. I know you're doing it right, 'cause you're beginning to glow. I'll miss your earthly presence, but I know your conscious won't end. Thank God for reincarnation, I know we're gonna see you again. See the memories move on past you. Take our love as it burns like a spell. As you move on to your next phase, to where the ancestors dwell. Let your judgment be your conscience. Oh, brilliantly you have lived your life. I see your heart is light as a feather.
Gravel crunched under our feet as we made our way from our end of the old country road to the other. It was a skinny stretch of blacktop with plenty of cracks and patches from two hot summers butting up against two cold winters. A couple of the residents had taken to scattering gravel on it to make the traction a bit easier in the snow and rain. This was our fourth year of living on the street, which was tucked away from the nearby town, separated by miles and miles of cornfields. Like our own little town. Trees lined the roadway, and at the end, we even had a precious white clapboard chapel, the most picturesque steeple you've ever seen.
Papa?
My son Ryan asked.
Do you think they'll have ice cream this time?
Oh, I don't know, pal, I replied, knowing our hostess wasn't exactly fond of sweets. But I bet a big slice of pie would be good, won't it?
But it's made of yams, he said.
And I realized then that being an adult is having to act enthusiastic about a pie that nobody wants, but we're all going to have to eat. His little face looked down at the dish he was carrying. Our hostess for the evening always forbids me from cooking, as she insists on doing it all herself. But I felt as though my southern DNA would somehow turn against me if I showed up to someone's house for dinner without a covered dish. I felt a bit guilty, because it was basically a giant casserole dish that I'd filled with a mixture of tater tot sour cream, a can of Rotel, a little bit of sausage, and a metric ton of cheese. Ryan isn't out of the picky eating habits of childhood quite yet, and I wanted to avoid a meltdown like last year.
Papa?
Ryan looked back up at me, a far more serious look on his face this time.
Do we have to go to Miss Blackburn's house?
Why do you ask, bud?
It's...
He looked down again, briefly, deciding something.
Dale says she's a witch.
I chuckled a bit. Oh, does he now?
Yeah, and he says Anthony told him...
Oh, so Anthony says she's a witch, I asked, playing detective.
Yeah, but Dale says it too. So Anthony told Dale that she can fly in a broom and talk to dead people, and if you eat her food, she puts spells on you.
And what did you tell Dale when he said that Anthony said those mean things about sweet old Miss Blackburn?
I didn't...
Ryan caught himself before admitting that he likely hadn't stood up for our elderly neighbor as after promising he would. When he resumed, his tone was that exhausted, beleaguered, elastic manner of speaking that only a small child can achieve.
But, Dad, she's always staring at people from her porch, and she doesn't even have any candy. It's Halloween. How do you not have candy?
I laughed, which made my son squish his face up in consternation, believing I wasn't taking any of this seriously. He had me there. Mostly, I was laughing at the fact that he thought she was a witch because she didn't have candy, when I thought that with witches, it was supposed to be the other way around. Miss Blackburn isn't staring at people because she's a witch, I gently admonished. She's just keeping up with the neighborhood. She can't get out much anymore, and it helps her feel like she's still part of the community.
But, Dad, yam pie?
He had a point. We'll go for ice cream after, I relented. He perked up right as we arrived at our destination. The tall, old farmhouse belonging to Miss Blackburn looked like the kind of thing that wouldn't be made by a contractor today. It was either two stories or four stories, given the odd spacing of the windows on the sides of the house and the way parts of the roof sort of jutted upwards. I guess when you're a kid, it could look like a creepy place where children are turned into supper, but all it made me think of was how grateful I am for building codes. I knocked on the glass storm door as Ryan fidgeted with a dish in his hands, eager to be freed of the burden of a tater tot casserole. The old woman had left the actual front door completely open, which I knew was an invitation to let yourself in, but again, southern DNA. I knocked again, and finally she rounded a corner. She was a bit bent and knobbly in that way where your body can almost feel how good her hugs would be.
Well, come on in, she said, not halfway to the entryway.
Her voice was a bit cracked and whistled, like air passing through exposed laths in an old wall.
I left the door open, honey.
Accepting the permission, I opened the door and my little boy ran in before me and handed the woman the dish. Well, he didn't so much hand her the dish as he sort of shove-tossed it into her bony hands and made for the other end of the hallway, his rushed greeting, whatever it was, because I couldn't make it out, trailing behind him.
Oh, gosh, sorry about that, Miss Blackburn, I said, lunging forward a bit to take the dish out of her hands.
Think nothing of it, honey, she said,
her eyes wrinkling into a smile as she tilted her head up to grin at me. It's good to hear little feet in this house again. She led me down the hallway and started to tell me about the aches and pains of daily life, some physical, some not. The smells in the house were warm and spicy, making my brain do that thing where your memories all jump up at once and try to crowd together at the forefront in an attempt to be remembered first. Instead, the clove and onion and garlic hanging in the air made me feel like I was somehow a very small person in very large clothes, or perhaps the other way around. Ryan had made himself at home at the dining table, fidgeting with the decorations. "Careful with those, buddy," I said from the kitchen. "He's fine," Miss Blackburn said, turning back to the stovetop to attend to a simmering pot of stew in a large cast iron pot. "He can't hurt nothing. It's just some corn husk dollies. I make them every year." "Still," I replied, keeping my eyes on the little hands holding the fragile doll. "He shouldn't fuss with things that don't belong to him, especially when he didn't ask. Again, sorry about that, Miss Blackburn." "Lakey," she said, pronouncing the name with a long E at the end. "Call me Lakey, please." "Of course." Finally deciding that the tablescape was likely not going to crumble under the 7-year-old's touch, I turned into the most helpful house guest. "Put me to work," I offered. "What can I do?" She wordlessly turned to face me, her hand never leaving the large wooden spoon that was stirring the pot, and looked at the casserole dish still in my hands. I wouldn't describe the look as kind, though it might fit best in the concerned for your mental health category. "Well," she said, trying very hard to put words together that would still permit her to hold on to her Midwest nice demeanor. "How about you set the table?" I looked back at the dining table that had already been carefully laid out with a well-loved tablecloth and a stitched fall leaves pattern with white placemats on top. Plates, cutlery, glasses, already in their proper places. I was being shooed out of the kitchen. "Miss?" A tiny voice surprised us both. We turned around to find that Ryan had snuck up on us. Children's shoes should come with bells or proximity sensors or something. "Miss Blackburn?" he said again, corndog gripped tightly in his little hands. At this, the old woman stopped stirring, tapped the spoon on the side of the pot, and laid it gently across the top in one smooth motion. "Well, hello there, honey," she said, hand firmly planted on her hip. "How can I help you?"
"What's that?"
he asked, pointing at the pot on the stove.
"This here?
Why, it's our dinner." She took the spoon and, with a hefty stir, held out a small amount of stew.
"Want a taste?"
Hungry and terrified look the same on a small child's face. To be fair, they likely look the same on an adult's face, too. Then my sweet angel of a boy said the one thing I had been hoping he wouldn't.
"My friend Dale says you're a witch."
His words came out in a rush of breath, strung together like a chant of protection. His eyes remained fixed on the spoon in front of him. "I don't think," I started, but Miss Blackburn jumped in.
"Is that all?"
she asked with a giggle.
"I wondered what had crawled up your jeans when you zipped in here earlier."
His eyes bulged, and I had to resist the urge to follow suit. I was fairly sure she was kidding, but while the chances of the little old lady at the end of the lane inviting you over for supper served out of a simmering cauldron being a witch are low, they are never zero.
"Dale says if I eat your food, you'll put a spell on me."
Ryan's eyes never left the steaming spoon in front of him. Miss Blackburn's face turned to me.
"That little Jacob's boy that used to live in the greenhouse down the way?"
I chuckled. "Yes, ma'am. Same one."
"Well," she said in a theatrically exasperated tone, "I guess nobody can keep secrets anymore."
She winked at me, but Ryan missed it as his whole world was collapsing in front of him.
"Oh, now you quit listening to silly boys and their silly stories, honey,"
she relented, pointing the spoon in Ryan's direction before swinging it back around, returning its contents to the pot. He let out a sigh of relief.
"So
You don't cast spells on people?
He asked. I was enjoying this. Nope, she said, turning the burner down a bit.
You don't ride on a broomstick?
He asked. Oh, I wish, but no. Brian paused a moment, then asked with a slightly heavier tone.
You don't talk to ghosts either, right? Now that, she said, stretching the vowel as she put the lid on the pot and turned the fire down until it was barely a flicker of blue underneath the massive cast iron.
That I do.
Oh, this was going to be good.
You do?
Ryan asked, a rush of energy finding its way back into his voice.
Well, now come down, sit, and let me spin you a little yarn, she said as though she were about to explain how she plants tomatoes every year.
Ryan looked at me, puzzled.
It means she's going to tell us a story, I whispered.
We made our way to the dining table where she took a seat at the end and gestured for us to take the two opposite. She twisted a bit in her seat, settling into the plush cushion tied to the chair back. Taking a deep drink of water, she closed her eyes and began.
You two are still pretty new to our little community here on Mahala Street, so you may not know that our family used to be the only ones living out here. My daddy, Leander, was the preacher at that little old church over yonder. The schoolhouse was a long way away, and we didn't always have time to go, so me and my sisters and brother, we spent our days helping Mother with the garden and the goats and the laundry and whatever else needed doing. On long summer days, we'd wander around the fields after chores were done or go play in the churchyard. Well, it happened that when I was a little girl, goodness, I was probably your age, there's a pretty bad blizzard and another and another. It was a long winter, to say the least. We couldn't make it out of the house for what felt like months, but what I later found out was about 5 or 6 weeks. Lucky, Mother and Daddy were always prepared and had spent the whole summer storing canned fruits and peppers and vegetables. We had plenty of grain and corn, so we thought. There's a difference in keeping a few things stored away and suddenly having to feed all us 7 kids. When we'd run out of jars and flour and most everything else, Mother took to making these thin griddle cakes out of cornmeal and water. Cornfields weren't quite like they are now, but we had more corn than we had most anything else. Even that, after a time, got low. It's not like now where you get in your car and zip on down to the grocer after Mr. Thomason down at the corner plows the road when the snow gets high. No, you hope to get somewhere when there was a whole mess of snow on the ground. You had to dig your way to town or hope your horse could get you through. That's what Daddy did. He saddled up old Bull. That was our biggest horse, Bull. Went off early in the morning into the snow, promising he'd be back that evening. That was about the last time I saw Daddy, till his funeral a week later after the snow cleared up enough for some of the men to bring him back home. We buried him in that cemetery right over there next to the church. Back then it wasn't very full like it is now. By the end of that winter, the cold would take my younger brother Jack and my older sisters Flora and Anne. I think I was a bit too young to know how to feel lost or to grieve proper, but I knew my mother was going through it pretty rough. Eventually, the cold broke and the snow melted. The church came together and gave Mother a little money to see us through, and some church lady or other would come around about once a week to help tend to the house and keep the pantry filled. That spring, Mother took the money she'd gotten and made a go of turning the family's garden into a business. It did okay, especially once she started selling fruit pies that summer. She'd go on to open a bakery in town. My sister's kids still run it. But Clara's? You might have been. Anyway, one afternoon that summer, after chores were done, my sisters were working on a quilt with Mother. I was too young to feel obligated, so I went on a walk by myself. My sisters didn't like going for walks anymore because the church was so close and that meant seeing our family buried there. Graves take a while to settle, you see. I was young, so, like I said, I guess I didn't know to be unsettled. By then, the cornfields had started to grow. All the green stalks were up to my head. I walked down to my daddy's church and made my way past the flowers and on up the path. It was laid out like a garden.
mostly because they had the room and filled the place with flowers until it was time to dig a new plot. What struck me was that when I passed my family plot, there was a big green corn stalk that had grown up right in front of my daddy's grave. I could only assume that maybe a seed had blown over from the nearby field and found itself in the fresh dirt. I didn't think nothing of it except that daddy'd hate it. He ate mother's vegetables because she grew them, but he'd rather have a big piece of meat and some potatoes and call it a meal. Now that I think about it back, I sometimes chuckle at how being surrounded by all those cornfields probably felt like some kind of vegetable hell. I sat there talking to it for a little while. Not sure why, but it was a living thing adjacent to Daddy's grave, and it was just so odd that it was there in the first place. Maybe I thought it was magic. Either way, it fascinated me. In the following days, I stole away every chance I got to come walk the garden out behind the church. I'd bring a small jar with me and fill it up from the pump behind the church to water that little corn stalk. Sometimes I'd bring things, shiny rocks I found or pieces of thread from the house I thought were pretty, and I'd put them on their graves. After a time, the stalk had some full-grown corn on it. I found it one day after Mother had worked us pretty good in the house, scrubbing floors and getting ready for a visit from the new pastor. So I was pretty hungry, and I did what any right-minded person would. I took a piece and gave it a once-over to look for bugs and bit into it. I knew before I finished that first bite that I wasn't alone anymore. I turned around. There he was, my daddy, all cleaned up and nicely dressed like he'd just come off the pulpit. Oh, I'd have been scared if it had been anybody else, but I could never be scared of him. I gave him a big old hug, and he smelled like laundry that's been out on the line with a good stiff breeze on a summer day. He told me he loved me, and I told him I missed him. We talked a good long time. He asked after the family. I asked what heaven looked like, but Mother rang the supper bell, and I turned my head at the sound, and when I turned back, he was gone. Mother and my sisters didn't believe me when I told them I spent the afternoon with Daddy, or at least they thought I was being imaginative about my time out in the churchyard. It was several days before I was able to steal away a little time again. After maybe a week or so, though, I went back. The stalk was still there, and another cob was ready to be picked. I ate it immediately, and my daddy showed up again. He and I talked and played. He said my meemaw was teaching my brother and sisters how to quilt, except in heaven, they quilt clouds. He pointed up at the sky to show me some. There's a funny-looking one that looked all frayed at the edges. He said that was my brother's, because he'd given up and gone to skip rocks with Papaw. He asked about Mother and my sisters. I told him Clara liked a boy, and he asked a bunch of questions but seemed to settle down when I told him it was Deacon Bellamy's son. And the dinner bell rang, and try as I might not to be surprised by it, my body knew if I didn't attend to it, I'd get a whooping. Daddy was gone. But I knew there was still corn growing, and that meant there was time. I kept trying to get away to go visit Daddy, but Mother kept us busy at home. Preacher had been coming around more often. I think he was sweet on Mother at the time, but she sure didn't return the favor. Maybe that's why he kept coming by, hoping to win her over. I remember he brought us girls some ribbons and little gifts. He gave me a music box, which I loved because we didn't get a lot of music except at church on Sundays. Finally, after several days that felt like weeks, I found I had a little time to myself. I took my new music box and put my new ribbon in my hair and went to go see Daddy. I filled a little water jar and gave some to the flowers like always, walked up the path to where my family lay. When I got there, though, that stalk had been knocked over by something that wanted to get at the corn. I was devastated. I laid on that dirt over his grave and cried and cried until I just about couldn't cry no more. Made me thirsty even. After a time, I decided I might as well play that music box for my daddy anyway, even if he couldn't be there with me. So I wound it up and opened the lid, and that tinkly little tune started playing. And I stood up and closed my eyes and started dancing. Then, I don't know how, I felt my daddy's hands in mine. When I opened my eyes, there he was, smiling at me. He told me how pretty my hair looked, I kept winding that music box up so it wouldn't end. We didn't talk a lot that time because I didn't quite have the language to give him a proper goodbye. I didn't know a lot, but I could feel that this was the end of the magic. When the dinner bell rang that night, I looked up. Daddy was gone again. I picked my things up and went on back to the house for supper. Ryan had sat through the whole story, wide-eyed and silent. The old woman took a deep sip from her glass to indicate she was done.
But, how did he show up without the corn? Ryan asked,
which was good because I'd also felt like there was a plot hole or two. Now, see, I'd wondered that myself, she said. But I imagine the dead aren't as far away as we make them out to be. You show them a little love, you go see them from time to time, let them know they're remembered. They talk back to you sometimes. Ryan seemed to accept that answer, and I felt relatively pleased that his urge to grill Miss Blackburn for being a witch had abated. Dinner was delicious. About halfway through, some of the other neighbors from Mahala Street arrived to call on Miss Blackburn. The house was full and lively, and the food was plenty. After a time, I could see the sun setting through the kitchen window and wanted to make one last stop before putting Ryan to bed. We said our goodbyes and took our leftovers, which somehow consisted of the entire tater tot casserole. Quietly, we made our way down the street to the old white church, then around back through the flower beds and into the cemetery. We settled down in front of the grave. It had been a year, but every time we came here, the wounds felt as fresh as the day we'd buried her. Inspired, I decided to go see if the old water pump was still behind the church so I could spruce up the irises we'd planted at the headstone. I walked away to the sound of my little boy peeling back the aluminum foil from the casserole and putting a handful on the grass. I found the red spout with a plastic water pitcher hanging off it, but the lever was firm from lack of use. I just managed to get the water flowing when I heard Ryan's voice. Mama! He cried. I turned to see what was happening and dropped the pitcher.
Black man's moving as it's walking on down the street. Shoulders swinging to and fro to a sound of a silent beat. Yes, keeps him moving with confidence, grooving upon his chosen course. It's inherent, he got it from his parents from the day that he was born. That's the rhythm of the ancestors talking from songs of yesterday. Never quite gone, never quite forgotten. Just spit it through the DNA. I bobo, head to the tail. Ashe, ashe. Come on and see. Come on and hear. And I hope you enjoy the soul from the side. And I hope that you find your flow. See the hips of a black woman's triple as she's walking on down the street. See you work on the dance floor as she turns on that central heat. Yeah. Make the man on the dance floor come and visualize. So it comes to no surprise. They wanna take that ride. And it was done by everyone. The Ashe controls the doors of time and chance. And then the one God come and the ancestors do appear and start to dance. And they say, I bo bo bo, head to the dead. Ashe, Ashe.
psychic radio. Come on, feel them songs. Tell me, can you feel the spirit moving? Or tell me if you can. From the jazz to the rhythm to the blues to the gospel, everybody, can I get an amen? We're at the center of music innovation, and you know that we never stop. Because the black and the white and the yellow and the brown love reggae and hip hop. A capoeira and Brazilian rhythm are certainly here to stay. I wouldn't be surprised if we take music to yet another stage. I love to be alive then. I sure would love to stay, 'cause I'm just dying to see who's gonna turn the page. Ay, bo, bo, bo. Ete, pete. Ashe, ashe. Come on and see. Come on and hear it all again. And I hope that you enjoy the song. From the psychic radio, and I hope you will find your flow. From the psychic radio, I bo bo bo, ashe ashe. Psychic radio, and I hope you will find your flow from the psychic radio. Yo, 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 from the psychic radio. Yo, yo, yo. My psychic radio. Yo, yo, yo. Yo, 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 yo. From my psychic radio. Yo, 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 yo. From my psychic radio. Yo, yo, yo. Yo, 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 yo
When you gaze in the mirror, what do you see? Look beyond your face, your eyes. Can you feel your heartbeat? Hear your soul? You're alive. You're alive. You're alive. You're alive. The image on the tarot card is asking me, can't you see that the answers are inside of you?
Just about wraps up 2020's installment of Inciting a Hallowed Riot. I know that this year has been big and scary and strange and off for a lot of people, but I hope that this show has helped to inspire you, to recenter you, to help you find a little pocket of time when you can feel connected to the rest of the magical community. I do encourage you to check out the show notes at incitingariot.com and support the musicians, storytellers, and creators that were featured here on tonight's episode. It is my sincerest wish that this episode finds you and your family safe and well. It's time for me to bid you adieu. But of course, it wouldn't be Samhain if I didn't tell you. I hope that your moons are always full, your hats are always pointy, and your magic flows through you all year long. Blessed be, rioters. In love and light, firelight.
To begin, take a step, move ahead and do your best. There is power and intent. Use your dreams to reinvent yourself. Child of light, and in darkness shining bright. All the fires you get.
sincere and be thankful for the infinite power of the universe. Thankful that the power within is love. Thankful to be an integral part of creation. Thankful. To exist is a gift. Yes, and life magnificent. We can shake and we can bake. We can give and we can make good love. And do so much. We've got our hands and we can touch. Reaching out and building trust. And our friends, they mean so much. We can walk and we can talk. We can teach and carry talk.
Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.